Let's start. Good morning. Good morning, everybody. The number of students already reduced, unfortunately. I'm very sorry about that. Well, this semester we talk about diagnostic medical image processing. And so far, we have seen an introduction that was more or less a motivation of all the exciting topics that we are going to consider within the lecture. And last week, we started to look into the algorithmic part of the lecture. First, we started with the singular value decomposition. That is basically nothing else but a standard decomposition of matrices, where the factors allow for a very nice geometric interpretation. SVD and the decomposition of a matrix is very supportive to solve many, many problems that can be formulated in terms of linear algebra. So if we know SVD, we are on the safe side with respect to our linear algebra knowledge. So then Marco introduced last week the first chapter on image preprocessing. That's the first part of the lecture where we consider preprocessing algorithms to improve the image quality of those images that are used by the physician, by the radiologist for coming up with a diagnosis. And we also know that the imaging tools that we are using in a radiology department nowadays always relies on effects that we know from physics. And based on these effects and the physics modeling we are using, sometimes we know which artifacts show up in the image, and we can think about how to remove these artifacts by knowing a lot about the image acquisition procedure. And we started to look at one very specific case last week where we use image intensifiers in X-ray imaging. We know about the principle how X-ray images are generated. So we have our X-ray tube, then the photons of a certain energy are generated by the X-ray tube. The photons are propagated on straight lines through the object, through the patient. And at the end, we just look at the balance sheet of the energy of the photons. So while a photon is traveling along a straight line through the human body, hopefully along a straight line, is traveling through the human body, dependent on the tissue classes the photon has to walk through, it loses energy. Yeah? And at the end, we can measure how much energy was kept by the X-ray particle or the photon. And this energy is visualized in terms of an intensity value in our image. Yeah? And the problem the image intensifier solves for us is the transformation of the photon energy into an intensity image. Yeah? That's what the image intensifier does. And the image intensifier is making, is making use of a rather old technology. This is known since the mid-50s that this can be used. It's making use of a vacuum tube, like the old TV systems, yeah, the big ones with the vacuum tubes. And what is done is the photons, they hit the surface of the image intensifier. Marco explained this to you. And then the photons, they just release some electrons. And these electrons are accelerated within the vacuum tube. The photons are accelerated using a electronic optics. And this is done to amplify the original signal that is generated by the photons. So if we accelerate electrons in a vacuum tube, then we know that we have particles that carry an electricity. They are moving within the Earth's magnetic field, and due to our basic physics knowledge, we know that these particles are deviated by the magnetic field. And this leads to a distortion in the image. That means the electrons in the vacuum tube, they are deviated, and this type of deviation should be corrected within our algorithmic setup. And that's what we have learned last week, how this can be done. So we have two images. We have two images. The corrected image, that is the undistorted image, and the distorted image. And the distorted image. And here we know that the image points that we observe are due to a deviation of the electron beam. That means the position of the intensity value in this image is somewhat distorted. So if we use a regular grid, for instance, and map a regular grid by our optical system, this regular grid will somehow be distorted. So if I have the situation like this, I have here a grid with these points. This grid will be somehow distorted by the image acquisition device. Yeah? The question is, how can we, for instance, align the points that we have here parallel lines as in the original one? And what we did is we said we are computing a mapping from the corrected to the distorted image, where we plug in the two coordinates in the undistorted image, and we end up with the x coordinate in the distorted image, respectively with the y coordinate of the distorted image. And then we take the next one, we compute the mapping of the xy coordinates into this image, and then we take the intensity value of that point and bring it over to the corrected image. And by this iterative process, we can compute the corrected image based on this mapping that we compute in a calibration step. And based on the observation. Let me just repeat briefly how the estimation of the calibration mapping is, or the distortion function is done. So the estimation this is all repetition, right? So we are just repeating what we have seen last week. What we have seen is we have points f, x, I, and y, I. This is a point in the image plane of corrected image. And then we map this by a mapping f, and we say we get the coordinate x, I prime. This is the x coordinate of our distorted image. And then we do the same with another mapping. Let me call it g x I y I, and this results in y I prime. And we get these two equations here for all I in, let's say, 1, 2, up to n, if I have n points. So I have n points here where I know the correspondence due to the to the setup with the calibration pattern. For those of you who do not have this picture in mind, what do? I manufacture a regular grid with dots. I know where these dots are due to the manufacturing process. I put these dots right on the image intensifier and I grab images. And I know where these points should be according to the manufacturing process, and I know where these points are in the image. And that's the way I construct this type of mapping. And we have seen how to compute this mapping. How can we compute this mapping? The parameters of this mapping, or of the two mappings. What was the core idea? We did a so-called least square estimator. We did a least square estimator saying that we have the xi, yi. This is supposed to be the xi prime. So we compute the difference of that and the square. If these two are the same, this difference will be 0. If the two are very close to each other, it will be very small. And then we sum this over all the points that we observe, and we do the same for our gxi yi minus yi prime square. And then we minimize this with respect to the parameters of f and g. And f and g was selected to be a polynomial last week. Yeah? So we compute the polynomial parameters. These square estimators are very, very important. We will use them quite often in the future. And you should really start to think in terms of least square estimators if you have to deal with problems. Let me just give you another example for a least square estimator, and then we will continue with a new chapter or subchapter. Let's try to solve this together now. There is a very practical, nice problem that we are considering now. Let me just bring up here something. Hold on. Just unplug this. You should not see my internal mess I have. This is an example I just want to show you, which is very simple but shows you all the power of all this. Very practical problem. Hold on a second. Now it should come back. Sorry. Where is it? My signal. No? Ah. Very practical problem. It's basically the same, but what we have done here, but in a different context. So, just for your motivation, I know these things you easily remember. If you have the map of Europe, how do you explain someone where Erlangen is?
Yeah, just say the capital, where is the capital, how far away is from
the capital? Yeah, I mean, where is the heart of Europe? I mean, that's basically where someone who is traveling from Prague to Paris has to go through. Someone who wants to travel from Oslo to Monaco has to travel through. So if you take all these most important routes, you instantaneously see basically where we are. Yeah, that's the heart of Europe. And that's one of the most favorite slides of our president. If he explains where we are from worldwide, he's showing this slide. And as an engineer, the obvious question is he right? What do you think? Of course he's right, the president is always right, but as an engineer, usually we have to walk through the world with a certain mistrust. And now let's think about equipped with the technology we have learned 2 weeks ago and last week, SVD, least square estimators. Can we compute the intersection, the average intersection of these points? How would you do that? So we solved the problem, where is Erlangen? How would you solve this? I mean, we have here straight lines. How would you represent straight lines? Don't think in terms of a sphere where we all sit on. Just think about a plane, okay? For simplicity, we think that we are 500-600 years back and we sit on a plane, okay? Plane, planar, linear manifold. Not a plane, not an airplane. How would you represent a straight line in 2D? Well, so we have a straight line, line number one. We know each line in 3D is represented, or in 2D, by a normal vector and by its distance to the origin, right? Right? That's how we represent a plane, or a linear line, sorry, or an hyperplane in the d-dimensional space. So if we look at the ith line, we just compute here the normal vector times x is equal to di, and all the points x that fulfill this equation sit on the line. Okay? Cool. And this is true for I is 1 to n if I have n straight lines. How do I compute the intersection? What is true for the point of intersection of all the straight lines? They all fulfill the equations. Instead of saying ni transposed x di is ni transposed x is di, I write that this is required to be zero. And if we have a point that is very close to the intersection of all the straight lines, but it's not exactly the intersection, what I can do is I can set up a least square estimator and the least square estimator is nothing else doing but we look at all the straight lines, we compute ni transposed x minus di square and we minimize this for x. That's a two-dimensional optimization problem. We just minimize this. The straight lines are known. We know the ni's, we know the di's, and then we look for the point x1, x2 that minimizes this term. How do we optimize this quadratic function? Well, quadratic functions have the nice properties that they have a unique solution in terms of its extremes. So we just compute the partial derivative with respect to the components of x and the zero crossings, and we are done. Yeah? And last week, we have seen here the polynomial mapping and here the point of our calibration panel. It's always the same. Very powerful technique. Yeah? So end of the example. By using this idea, we can solve tons of problems of practical relevance, as I have shown to you with this very nice example. Good. Any questions so far? This was a little fast, but I'm just repeating things. I didn't check the GPS coordinates. If you want to know the truth, what I think it's not true. It's an illusion, an optical illusion. Yeah. But it's a nice optical illusion. Good. Okay. Do you have vaguely the feeling that you know what I'm talking about so far? Yes? And you? Good. And now we talk about the second type of detector technology that is used nowadays as a standard detector technology in X-ray imaging. If you use the correspondence with TVs, you are pretty much at the right place. If you look at the development of TV or evolution of TV sets, you remember you had the big ones, maybe you still had one when you were a child with a vacuum tube, and now if somebody has still a TV system at home with a vacuum tube, he's tremendously uncool. That's at least what my kids told me. Yeah, it's tremendously uncool to have a vacuum tube TV set. And in X-ray imaging it's the same. The old ones have these vacuum tubes. You go into a radiology suite, you see the vacuum tube, and you know this is outdated technology. So if you see an X-ray system with one of these buckets, yeah, you can say this is outdated. Since 10, 15 years, nobody is buying a new system with this type of detector technology. Yeah? If you go to some smaller labs of physicians, you will sometimes still be happy if you would see this vacuum tube technology, because they are still using film technology, but that's way more outdated. So we have the vacuum tube in TV sets, and we have the flat screen technology. And that's the same now with our detectors. We have the vacuum image intensifiers, vacuum tubes, and we have the so-called flat panel detectors. And we will look now We will now have a look at the flat panel detector technology. And the usage of the flat panel detector technology has one outstanding advantage from an engineering point of view. What is it? What do you think? Ah, you think far too advanced. I'll just take off my shirt here. This is all recorded. Well, I will stop at this point. Don't worry. Yeah, I'll not continue. That's right, but that's far too advanced. I mean, we were fighting with the image intensifiers due to the fact that the electrons are deviated by the magnetic field. So the first thought we should have, are still image distortions visible that are induced by the Earth magnetic field? And the answer is no, image intensifiers are not sensitive to magnetic fields. So we will not have to deal with the problem we have considered last week. We get just rid of the problem. It's no longer present. We don't have to calibrate the distortions implied by the Earth magnetic field. But there are other artifacts. And you are aware of these artifacts if you have a notebook or if you have a flat screen at home, because sometimes you see some red dot pixels or some pixels that are not working. And you will be very, very, very annoyed by these pixels, because you look at your screen and you right away see out of the millions of pixels you have the defect pixel. Yeah, and then you go back to your vendor and the vendor tells you, look, up to 3 pixels, it's okay, that's the quality standard we meet. And you go back home, you open your notebook, you look at your screen and you right away see this defect pixel and you're very annoyed by that. That's due to the manufacturing process of these TFT panels or of our flat panels that we are considering for capturing X-ray images. These are very, very hard to produce, and we have to deal with defect pixels. So we will have pixels that do not provide valuable or the real measurements. They have some failure in it. And of course, we want to sell these defect detectors to a certain extent and bring them on the market, because otherwise we lose a lot of money. And in X-ray imaging, we are in the nice situation that our detector captures a signal. The signal is then processed somewhere on a computer and then shown on the screen. So what we could do is we could have a sandpaper institution right there sitting in the computer. When the signal comes and there is a defect, we take our sandpaper and we just, you know, smear this pixel using the environment and then show it to the doctor and hope that the doctor does not see that there is some sandpaper operation in between. Yeah, we call this defect pixel interpolation. And to a certain extent, this defect pixel interpolation is something that is allowed. And as a matter of fact, this is also done in all the X-ray systems that are out there. There are detectors that have minor defects, and these minor defects are calibrated, and with a sandpaper algorithm, these defects are interpolated. They are smeared away, okay? So that's the picture we have, or the illustration that we have in mind while looking at the upcoming chapters. So we have defects and we do sandpapering. Why is your computer manufacturer not sandpapering with your TFT monitor? Because this is the device to visualize the image. So there is no software in between. It's just the electronical setup that generates the image you see. And if there is a defect, you cannot use a software solution to get rid of this defect. No? So that's the difference. That's the story for today. And now let's look at the details. Where is my pointer? Here is a pointer. So we replace the buckets and the film technology by a flat electronic detector. Yeah. And the flat panel technology implied a huge change in radiology. Because these detectors are flat, you can also have wireless detectors. You can basically use them like you use film cassettes, just your digital device that records the images. And in radiology, a lot of things have changed with the introduction of the flat panel technology. And the flat panel technology started in X-ray imaging, let's say 10, 12 years ago. Yeah? 10, 12 years ago, these systems came on the market and are replacing more and more the existing systems. And flat panels are well established in digital radiography. If you read digital radiography, what type of diagnostic procedure do you think about? If you hear me and my voice today and I'm you know, appearing some kind of sick, you might think, oh, does he have tuberculosis? Yeah, so I have to go to the hospital and I get a lung image. Yeah, that's digital radiography. You have time and you can look at bones and lungs and these things, digital radiography. Cardiology, what type of systems are these? If, you know, I'm a very stressed person, yeah? You know that? You know that, just say yes. Just say yes. I'm a very stressed person, so I have a high risk factor of heart attack, right? And imagine I have a heart attack. So what's going to happen? I will go into the cardiology department. They will fill up my blood with a contrast agent and they will look how my coronaries are doing. Whether there is a stenosis, whether there is enough blood support of the heart muscle. And they also use nowadays the flat panel technology. Yeah? And in mammography, what is mammography? Yes, yes. And if somebody wants to have an X-ray image of the mama, then you get these, you make use of the mammography system. So they are all using flat panel technology today. And how are these things look? How do these things look like? You have here the X-ray tube. Yeah. For instance, here it's mounted to the seal, the X-ray tube. X-rays are released. The patient is sitting here or lying here on the table. And here you have your cassette. And this is a digital detector that can also be removed. For instance, you can also mount this detector here on a column, floor-mounted column. Here you have your X-ray tube, and then people stand like this in front of the detector, and then you get your chest image, for instance, here as an example. Yeah? And here I have two systems. Just look at the images. The text is not so important. This one here is a cardiology system. This is a very small detector. Usually these cardiology detectors have a size of 23 centimeters by 23 centimeters, built by physicists, right? Because it's not a power of two. 23 centimeters by 23 centimeters. And it's small. Why is it sufficient to have a small detector? Yeah, you just want to see the heart muscle. And the heart muscle, yeah, the heart and the coronaries and the heart fits very well on these smaller detectors. And in the evolution of detector technology, these systems have been also the first ones that were using flat panel detectors due to its size. It was easier to manufacture the smaller ones, right? The smaller ones. So at the beginning of 2000, these systems were shipped, and these were the first systems, X-ray systems with a flat panel detector. This one is a flat panel detector system that is used for neuroradiology, so for stroke treatment, for stroke intervention, if somebody has some bleeding in the head or some problems with the head. You have here a so-called biplane system because you can simultaneously capture images from two different directions. And the detector is larger, 50 centimeters here. The detector is larger because you want to see the whole head, and the head is larger, right? So this was introduced somewhat later than this year. And these large detectors were initially built by using four smaller detectors and put them together. And there was also an artifact, the so-called butting cross artifact. We will see it later. Butting cross artifact, where you have your four plates to get the large detector. And here at the point where you glue them together, you have some mismatch, some offset, and that's visible in the images. And that can be also corrected for by using image processing methods. So cardiology, neuroradiology as another example. Here are 3D reconstructions that can be done out of the flat panel images that you capture. We will have, right before Christmas, several lectures on how to compute the three-dimensional density distribution within the human body by looking at X-ray projections. And flat panel detectors have the nice property, as you already mentioned, that the contrast resolution is way better. So you can distinguish in the projection tissue classes that are very, very similar to each other, but have minor different absorption properties of the X-ray quanta. You can visualize this in the projection, and this leads also to better 3D reconstructions. For instance, what do we see here? Can somebody tell me what we see here? Don't read the text. This is the spine. Yeah, the spine. If you are not familiar with the anatomy, you should just think about your lunch and dinner habits, most of the things you should remember from your table, right?
So the liver and the kidneys below.
Yeah, so you have here the liver, and here you have the kidney, and here you will see the second kidney, which is not in the image. And what type of problem do we see here? Would you say, oh, that's cool, that's, this guy is fine? Sehen Sie ein Problem? Yes? There's a tumor. Yeah. There's a tumor in the liver. And what the surgeon, for instance, needs to understand, how is the blood support of the tumor? Where are the big vessels within the liver? How can you do a resection of the tumor? So he wants to see here, for instance, in the angiogram, the vessel system, the vessel support. And then based on this three-dimensional information, he decides on the way the surgery has to be done. So these 3D reconstructions here were done using a flat panel system. If you use an image intensifier, you won't be able to generate images of this type of quality out of the X-ray projections, because the contrast resolution nowadays is not sufficient. Another killer application. I mean, if you come with a new technology on the market, you always have to show killer applications. Yeah, the term killer application in medical imaging is somewhat irritating, I would say. But let's use the terms of computer scientists. Yeah? A killer app means you just blow them out and they all want to have it. Yeah, that's killer app. That's not related to the application that we are considering. So you can reconstruct things that you haven't been able to reconstruct before to visualize. We have seen it on the previous slide. Another application is shown here. I mean, think about selling to someone flat panel technology. So you go to the doctor and you tell him, look, we have replaced the image intensifier by a flat panel. The images have the same quality like before. We just charge you 200,000 euros more. Isn't that cool? Would he buy the system? No. He needs some benefit out of that, which makes the investment worth. And the investment is justified by being able to diagnose more patients. Yeah, so you have a higher throughput, so you can make more money with the system. That's, for instance, one argument for using these flat panels in radiography, because you can just do more patients. You don't have to develop the film sheets and have a large process in the back. Another application is image quality. You see things that you weren't able to see before, so it has a real impact on your workflow and enhancement of the procedure. And a third example is shown here. That is out of the year 2003, when I was still with industry and we were thinking, what is the real advantage of this detector to make people buy it? And then we said, okay, the sensitivity with respect to magnetic fields is no longer present. And we built a system where we have huge magnets left and right of the patient, and the magnets help us to move the catheter into the right direction. So we apply an external magnetic field to make the catheter point into the right direction. So the vision we have in mind, and we will talk in summer semester about this, that the radiologist is no longer just inserting the catheter into the artery and then he looks at the images and moves the catheter by hand, but we want to have it like you are used to it with your plumber. Yeah, if you set if you say your toilet is clogged, what happens? The plumber comes, takes a wire, puts it in, pulls it out, and everything is fine. Yeah, and we would like to do the same. We want just put it in. Yeah, push without saying here at this bifurcation to the left, to the right, and so on. We won't just have an external magnet which always applies a magnetic field such that the tip of the catheter is moved into the right direction. That's the system we have in mind, and this requires magnets. And if you use an image intensifier for this setup and you switch on the magnet, the following will happen. You will see a very nice image where all the image information is basically reduced to a single point. Yeah? Where the magnetic field is just, you know, moving your whole image somewhere, but not where it should be. So that's one of the killer applications using magnetic navigation systems. The advantages, and please do not learn these things in the oral exam. Yeah? I will never ask you a question like, what are the advantages of flat panel detectors? I rather will ask you a question like, show me an algorithm for defect interpolation that is using Fourier transforms of, let's say, three dimensions in an efficient manner with an O n log n complexity or so. Yeah? So my questions will be way simpler than this type of thing. Yeah? Don't learn these things. You need to understand what's going on here. So the advantages. It's easy to build in, at least, to build into the system once the detector is available. You have a higher contrast resolution. Yeah, that means you can distinguish different tissue classes way better than in other ones. The insensitivity with respect to magnetic fields. It's more robust with respect to over and under exposure. So if too many X-ray quanta hit the detector, yeah, then it can happen that, you know, it's overexposed, and the question is, how does the detector deal with this type of thing? It has a very nice behavior with respect to that. It's smaller compared to the bucket. It's very much smaller. You might think, well, this is not so exciting for you. Might be, But for the doctor who is, you know, treating the patient, who is dealing with the system, I mean, the focus of the procedure, in the focus of the procedure is the patient, not the system, right? That's what we have to keep in mind. And if there are less space requirements, it's also more pleasant for the patient, yeah? And if the doctor says, okay, your finger hurts, so let's capture an image, and you go into a room where a monster system is sitting and you have to put your finger in and you don't know what's going to happen, that's not good, right? It helps to optimize the clinical workflow, and it also has some mechanical advantages. It's slow in readout. Why is that a problem? Well, if you want to read out an image, you might say, oh, for a thorax image, I mean, the patient walks in and then you capture the image and then the patient has to put back his shirt and so on. So you have enough time to read out the information of the detector and put it on the computer and do the post-processing and things like that. That's right. But in cardiology, for instance, yeah, you want to have image sequences. And nowadays, we work with 30 images a second. That means you have to read out 30 images in a second and to capture 30 images in a second. So this is a very important problem. And it's very hard to build, you know, detectors that fulfill the high demands of many application fields in medicine. We have a high rejection rate in production. So it's hard to manufacture, so there are many defect detectors, you throw away quite some detectors, combined with the fact that it's a very expensive technology, it's clear that you want to reduce the number of defect detectors. Things have changed over the past 10 years for sure. They are way better than they have been for 10 years. They are also way cheaper. But still, you have a rejection rate, and if you have minor defects, your expectation is that you remove these defects by digital image processing technology. And that's exactly what we are going to look into today. To give you an example what it means, higher contrast resolution. This is one and the same situation of a phantom. Here you see the images as they are acquired by an analogous system using film technology. And this is what you get if you use an image flat panel detector. And you see here, you know, these darker dots that are hard to see here. Now, this tells you you can differentiate different tissue classes way better because the spatial resolution here is way better. And the image quality, and please, that's something you should keep in mind. The quality of the images you see is defined by three major components. Three major components. If we talk about image quality, we have three major components. One is noise. If a homogeneous region is mapped to a very noisy picture, we say it's not a good picture. So the noise is an issue. The second thing is the spatial resolution. So what is the size of objects that I can still see in the image? Can I see things on a cell level, or do I see vessels of a tenth of a millimeter? Or do I see only structures that are 2 millimeters and larger? Yeah, very important issue. So what is the limitation in terms of spatial resolution of your X-ray imaging system? Now, if somebody has a very small crack in the bone and you capture an X-ray, do you see the crack in the bone or don't you see the crack in the bone? Yeah, at which point do you see it? What is the spatial resolution of your imaging system? And the third one is contrast resolution. So what we see here, how much can you differentiate between different tissue classes? So these are the two things.
So there's no subjective opinion of the doctor or something?
How is it with subjective opinions? Let me tell you a story. I mean, I was in industry and I have had to deal with image quality problems all the time. I mean, what happens? Yeah, your boss or the marketing guys, they go out to some customer in the US and then he comes back and says, the customer told me our image quality is poor. The images of General Electric or any of a competitor, they look way better. Yeah? And as an engineer, you say, so what? What does it mean he likes the images more? Yeah? Does that mean you have less noise? Does it mean you have a better contrast resolution? Does it mean you see things that you don't see in our image? I mean, at some point you have to bring things down to some quantification measures, yeah? And you can measure noise, you can measure spatial resolution, you can measure contrast resolution, but you cannot measure the subjective impression. Yeah, for instance, in medical image processing, I mean, we have a long tradition now. In hospitals, these systems like CT systems are used since mid of 70s. And they are very used to the artifacts that they see in CT images. So certain noise levels they are used to, or some streak artifacts they are used to. And if you start now to remove these things, what happens? If you talk to a radiologist who is very used to these systems, he looks at the images and misses, for instance, the artifacts. Yeah? And then, I mean, they just start to mistrust you. They know you did something to the images. Yeah? And at this point, they start to dislike the images because they don't trust you. Yeah? And the image quality is better. You can also show that you have less artifacts, you have a better signal-to-noise ratio, everything is better, but the subjective impression of the doctor is still, I don't like these images. Yeah? So it's difficult to deal with subjectiveness. Another implications of flat panels, for instance, cost reduction. If you think about, you know, radiography where you have the films and you have to archive the films for 10 years or more, I mean, keep all the films in the basement in an archive is very cumbersome. If you have digital images, you just have your digital backup devices and you can archive things more easily. You have improved image quality. What you also want to do is you want to apply the smallest possible dose to the patient. We know that X-ray imaging, you know, is not good for your health because the X-ray beams, they are ionizing. Yeah? So they can destroy the DNA. So you should really bring the X-ray exhibition to a minimum if you want to generate images. And with these digital detectors, we were able to reduce the amount of X-ray dose for the patient to get the same image quality like we had before with a higher dose. Yeah, that's always the trade-off we have to fight with. What is the amount of dose we apply and what is the image quality? And we just want to have the minimum dose with an image quality that is sufficient for diagnosis. So even if the images look very noisy and bad, you can say, okay, but I have not used so many X-ray particles being propagated through the human body, and the noisy image still shows information that is required to do the decision for the doctor. So it's completely sufficient. So that's a balance we have to deal with. Of course, the size of the detector is an issue, and the spatial resolution is another issue. So we want to be in the range of 50 to 150 microns here. Image quality, how is it measured? The typical measure is the signal-to-noise ratio. Who in the audience does not know what the signal-to-noise ratio is? You all know the signal-to-noise ratio? Perfect. So we have the DQE, the defective quantum efficiency. This is measured by the signal-to-noise ratio of the outgoing signal of the detector divided by the signal-to-noise ratio of the incoming signal, and by that you can say what is the quantum efficiency of the detector, so how much X-ray quanta is transformed into a usable and useful signal by using the detector. So the DQE numbers are very important. Now I have a few slides showing some flat panel detectors, and I'm very ashamed about the upcoming slides because they are 5-6 years old, and these are old detectors. I should update these things. This here, for instance, is a Pixium 4600. It's more a historic lecture now. Yeah, it's a historical reconsideration, 43 by 43 centimeters. So this one is useful for neuroradiology applications, or also for radiography applications. The resolution is 3000 by 3000 pixels, so a rather large one. You can easily compute the storage requirements of a single image if you work with 2-byte quantization. So you have 2-byte times 3000 by 3000 pixels. The pixel size is 140 microns, so 10 to the power of minus 6. And the quantization is usually done by 2 bytes with 14 bits valid signal. Can you read these numbers? You have a feeling what that means? So the intensities are represented by 14 valid bits. So you have intensity values that range from 0 to 2 to the power of 14 minus 1. Yeah? If you have an 8-bit sensor, 8-bit quantization, you have 255 different intensity values, 56 intensity values from 0 to 255. That's what it says. In medicine, usually we work with 2 bytes. Yeah? another example, you can buy these flat panel detectors from different vendors, and you can hook it up to your X-ray system, and you can build your standalone X-ray system. And like in image intensifier technology, where we had the cesium iodide layer, you remember that, that transforms the X-ray quanta into visible light using here scintillator technology. This is also used in flat panel technology. There are basically 3 different transformation techniques. The indirect conversion of the X-ray energy into an image and the direct conversion. In the indirect conversion, usually we have a scintillator where the X-ray quanta hit the scintillator and visible light is released. Yeah, visible light is released, and the visible light is then either captured by a CCD camera, that's what you have in your mobile phone, or by a photodiode and transformed or transmitted to a TFT array. And if you have a direct conversion, you have some material that transforms the X-ray quanta directly into charges that represent the intensity values. Yeah? And if you now attend lectures on medical physics, you will learn what type of material is used, what is the property of the material, which type of photons are released while hitting, while an X-ray quantum is hitting the material, and things like that. We will not look into this at all. For us, it's totally sufficient to say, okay, we have X-ray quanta, and the energy of the X-ray quanta is transformed into an image point, yeah? Into an image intensity point. And if we look at the structure of an X-ray flat panel detector, you always can keep in mind that this is a grid. You have here simply buckets. You can think about buckets. Each pixel is a bucket, and then you throw the balls. Yeah, you throw balls towards the grid, and they end up in some bucket. Yeah, and the bucket collects the energy within a time frame, and this is transformed into a intensity image. And you have to make sure that your balls end up in the right bucket. So you have here strong borders on the bucket. So if you throw a ball into it, it should stay in the bucket and not be scattered to another bucket. So for instance, the situation that an X-ray quantum hits the detector at this point and is then scattered and ends up to be this point here in the final image, this should be avoided. So we want to have a so-called collimator that collimates the signal. The collimator makes sure that one X-ray quantum ends up at a point in the final image where it hits the detector, and it's not scattered, not deviated. And the cesium iodide, for instance, is a natural structure that has this type of stick structure here, and makes sure that the X-ray quanta are kept in one of the sticks of the cesium iodide and transferred to the detector. And how do you read out the buckets? Well, you just have your switches, and you just look what is the charge of each bucket. You have the switching control, which says, okay, now I read out this bucket, read out this bucket, and then you have your readout logic here, and you measure the electric signal, and this is transferred to the computer. Yeah? So the image that is sufficient for us in the following is we have an array of buckets. We collect the balls. We make sure that the balls that fall into a bucket are kept there, and that they are not jumping out to some neighboring buckets or far away buckets. That's done by the collimator. And at the end, by using a readout electronics, we can just look what energy arrived in each bucket, and the energy is then transformed into an intensity image. Okay. And here is the simple structure. Usually the modern detectors work with amorphous silicon to do the transformation of the X-ray quantum energy into the signal that we are interested in. And what are the artifacts? Was this a question? No. What are the artifacts? And now it's getting more interesting. Yeah? Now we go into the algorithmic part of all this. Large detectors are composed by smaller detectors. And here, where you put together these detectors, you get the budding cross artifact. That's what I have written here. Then you have sometimes a bias, so you have an offset in intensities. So the pixel appears darker or brighter as it should be. Now, you can measure this offset, for instance, while installing a system. You have your X-ray tube, you have your detector. You put nothing in between the detector and the X-ray tube. You just activate the X-ray tube, and what you expect is a homogeneous X-ray image with identical intensities. And at some point, you will observe that the image is in the middle brighter, and the farther you go away from the center, it's getting darker. So you have an offset at this point, and this can be corrected in the calibration phase. Or you can also have inactive pixels, so pixels that are not working properly. And if you have pixels that are not working properly, you will have no valid signals. You can have a single pixel that is defect. And if your TFT monitor has a single pixel that is defect, you will really hate the monitor. You will see this, right? You can also have pixel clusters, whole image columns. So if the readout electronics is defect, a whole column can be defect, or a whole row can be defect. And these defects we have to correct for. So this is an extreme example. What do we see here? Except the defects. What do you see here? We want to talk a little bit about anatomy. It's a thorax. You see here the ribs, right? You see here the neck. You see here the shoulder. And what is this? The heart, right?
Pacemaker.
It's a pacemaker, yeah? Herzschrittmacher, pacemaker. Pacemaker. And this is the detector that I have built. Would you buy this detector? I mean, think about having here, you know, the rib is broken exactly here, or here is a tumor that is, let's say, of this size, yeah? Then the detector will not show that there is something. Yeah. So the defects here are extreme, and believe me, nobody will ship a detector with this type of defects. This is an extreme artificial example. But what we are now looking at is how can we build in-painting algorithms, yeah, to color these black spots here in a way that you don't see that there is an interpolation done, or there has been an interpolation done. And this interpolation can be done in different ways, and we will look into different ways. For instance, let's look at the following example that you get a good understanding of interpolation. Interpolation. So let's look at an academic example. X1, X2, so we are in 2D. Yeah? And I hope you don't see the line here. And I do now the following. I measure the function at these points. We call this sampling. Yeah, these are the sampling points. So we sample the function and I get here function values. Or for you to remember these things. So we are at a summer school. So the students are with the professor at a summer school, and each attendee of the summer school is required to provide a measurement. So now I'm learning your names. What's your name, sir? What's your name?
Nima.
Nima? Nima is measuring this value. Your name?
Miwa.
Miwa is measuring this value. Roman is measuring this value. Rebecca is measuring this value. Hornegger is having coffee, no value. Yeah? Joachim is having coffee, no value. Christian is measuring this value. And Tobias is measuring this value. Okay? So we have a defect here, clear. If you have a professor in the team, it can just go wrong. Okay? And now the question is, afterwards, you were sitting together, I'm still having coffee, and you were complaining about my performance. And now Rebecca is saying, well, let's ignore what whether he did it or not. We do an interpolation of the signal at this point. And what you see here is that this is more or less a straight line. And what you can do is now you compute out of these points the straight line, the function, the straight line. So n transposed x is d. And then you evaluate this function here at this point. Yeah? You just evaluate, if I plug in x1, what is the corresponding x2 value? And then you estimate this by interpolation. Yeah? And this here is called linear interpolation because you approximate here the function between two points as a straight line. If you have this situation, I'm not repeating the names, but because I don't remember them all. Nima? Ivo? Mivan. Mivan. So I have now this, for instance. This, and then Hornegger comes back with nothing, as usual. Yeah, okay. When I was in industry, as engineers, we were always complaining about people with ties. You know what that means, a tie? If somebody is wearing a tie, that just means no details. And it's true. I mean, you cannot talk to people with a tie about details. These are people usually in charge of the general picture, yeah? So no details. One of my students was very intelligent. I'm repeating myself, but it's very interesting. Once a student showed up in the oral exam with a tie. And I was very positive about this. I mean, he was saying, no details, please. Good. So here we have the same. Again, samples. It's not that clear that we have a linear function, but we can have, you know, a approximation of the whole signal by a piecewise linear function. And interpolation can be done by a linear interpolation here. You just connect the two points, neighboring sampling points, by a straight line, and then you just measure the point here by reading out the function value here, and we call this linear interpolation. That's linear interpolation. And let's consider now the situation. We have an image, and one column here is defect. And we have here our pixel values that are valid. And here we want to do a linear interpolation. Do I have a volunteer who can explain to me how the linear interpolation would be done for this missing pixel? Well, like in the above situation, yeah, we take the line, we look at the line at the intensity values, and then we compute the intensity value according to this linear function that we get if we look at the two neighboring pixels here. Okay? Can somebody tell me, how would you compute the line parameters that links these two values here? Let's say this is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and this is the value, let's say 5, and this is the value, let's say 2. How would you compute the slope? The slope is? Minus x1, and this would be in this particular case, 5 minus 2 is 3. I'm here to help. 6 minus 4, yeah, 2. Yeah, let's check it. 4 plus 2 is 6, so it's right. Yeah, so 2. So the slope is 3.5. Be critical. Is that true? Should be negative.
That's what I calculated.
So this difference, 5 minus 2 divided 4 minus 6. Yeah. Yeah. So we have here -3.5. How do you compute the translation, the offset, the intercept? Well, you just take one point that sits on the line, for instance, 4, 5, sits on the line. So we have 5 is slope times x. X is 5 plus t, and then we can compute t. Huh? And then we plug in, then we compute t, and then we plug in here the value. What I'm doing here? X 5 4. That's 4. Then I plug in 5 with a known t value, and I get here the y value. Yes. Yeah, then you are lost. Then you are lost. And that's that's regulated by laws, what to which extent you are allowed to do interpolation. And you are usually on the safe side. But a defect column or a defect line is something that happens in still modern detectors out in the field where interpolation is applied. Yeah, and then you can think about the next step, having quadratic functions here, yeah, and then requiring that the derivatives at this point of this function is the same, then you do spline interpolation and things like that. So the picture that you have in mind is the sampling points and the approximation of the function. And what I also want to make clear at this point is, sir? No, but your question is, how do I find out that this one is defect and providing not valid values? This can be done in a calibration step. Again, you have your X-ray tube, you have your detector, you have nothing in between the X-ray tube and the detector. You do an image, and then you will see the defect structures, and then you can calibrate for it. And then you know exactly at which point you don't have valid values. Right, but if there is no value, yeah, which says there is a zero, no value, or NIN, not a number, or whatever is sitting there, then you can do this type of interpolation. But we can identify the areas where defects are. Okay? This can be done in a pre-calibration step with the setup of the system. So we know about interpolation. Let me just explain to you three different things that you should not mix up. In math, you have learned three concepts. One is interpolation. One is extrapolation. And the other one is regression. Do you have pictures in mind? What is what? Well, interpolation means you have samples, and you make sure that you find a function that exactly hits the sample points, that exactly hits the sampling points, and then you characterize the whole function. That's interpolation. So hit samples exactly. Yeah? And interpolation means then you just compute here a point in between the function value. Extrapolation means you have here your samples. Do it this way. In a certain interval, you have your samples, and extrapolation means you want to get a value that is outside of the sampling range. So you want to have a value here. Extrapolation is what is done, for instance, on the stock market. Yeah? You have your samples, what was the current value of a certain stock, and you want to predict where it will be the next day. And if you think we have sufficient solution for the problem, you are wrong. Extrapolation is always driven by some heuristics. If there would be a smart solution to it, to do extrapolation, then I would be rich already and no longer here, right? And I would just extrapolate the current stock market and buy the right stocks, and tomorrow I'm rich and just leave the university. Yeah? So extrapolation is impossible. But what the analysts do in the evening, yeah, they can explain to you what happened during the day, and they can tell you exactly what was the reason for that, because then they get this additional sample here, and they can do an interpolation for the whole day and explain things properly. Yeah? That's the fight of this. And regression. Regression, if you have these samples here, yeah, you see it's roughly a straight line. And if you start to fit in a straight line here such that the average distance of the measured points to the straight line is minimum, then you have regression. In regression, not necessarily the function that we look for hits all the sample points, but minimizes something like a distance value, right? That's regression. So keep these three images in mind there. Interpolation. So interpolation can be done in spatial domain, and that's exactly what we did here. We have our intensity values, and we know where the samples are captured, and we do some sandpapering, yeah, by using interpolation techniques in spatial domain. Now, Stefan might say, that's simple, but that's not Horneger's style to keep things simple, right? So we will also think about a second type of interpolation scheme that will be done in frequency domain. How do I switch from spatial domain into frequency domain?
Fourier transform.
Yeah, we compute the Fourier transform of the image and do sandpapering in the Fourier transform. Yeah, and that's very interesting. That's very interesting and very powerful. The results look great, but I can tell you, in all existing systems that are out in the field, these spatial domain interpolation schemes are applied because they are more efficient and the resulting image quality is sufficient. The other ones are very academic, brilliant results, nice algorithms, complicated algorithms, easy to check within the oral exam, a lot of fun for everybody. But for the application, it's not that relevant. Okay? So this is for real life and this is for the exam. Yeah, and making your prof happy. Okay? Good. Here's an example of the butting cross artifact. So what we captured here is a grid structure, and you see here the glue area of the four detector plates. Yeah? And if you know what's happening here, you can write software that eliminates these artifacts. We will not look into this type of algorithm here, just to make you aware of that. So if you have a large detector, you should look at the images and look what happens around about the center, whether you can see some structures that might point or give a hint to the butting cross artifact. Here, for instance, is a screw, and you see here also, that's if you do not take care of the butting cross artifact, you get things like this here. And that's something, if a doctor looks at that, yeah, he will tell you, I don't like these images, there are artifacts, I cannot work with these images. Good. And before we talk about algorithms, we have to transform the problem of defect pixel generation into the language of mathematics. We have to formalize the problem. And I'll explain to you how we formalize the problem, and I will bring you on a level of excitement that will be unbelievable, because I'll tell you something that you never thought it will be solvable, right? So what is the situation we keep in mind? Let's look at an image. Let me draw the figure here. So we have our defect image. And here we have our defects. And let's say the defect pixels they have the value 0. Okay? And we call the defect image G. Okay? G. And then we have, on the left-hand side, we have the ideal image with no defects. We call this F, like fine. This is the fine image. This one is not measured. We measure the defect pixel. How can I get the defect pixel out of the ideal image? I just multiply pointwise the ideal image with a mask image that we call not M but W. Yeah, we turn around the M to make it more complicated. Yeah? The mask image. And in the mask image, we have ones if the pixel is valid, and zero if the pixel is not valid, if it's a defect pixel. So Wij is zero if the pixel is defect, one otherwise. So we multiply the ideal image we look for by a 0-1 mask pixel-wise, and we get the defect image. So what we measure is the product of a mask image that we can compute in advance by a calibration step with the ideal image. And how do we compute out of the mask image and the defect image, the original image? We just do a component-wise ratio, yeah? Ratio of the defect with the mask image. And the defect points we will get by dividing by zero. Yeah, and now you say, we can't do that. Yeah? I'll show you I can divide by zero. Yeah? That's the purpose of the lecture today. I'll tell you how to divide by zero. Yeah? Go to Horneger's lecture and you learn how to divide by zero. If your dad asks you tonight, what did you learn today? You can say, I can now divide by zero. That's the idea. I'm stressing this because you will remember this 10 years from now. Not how it works, but you will remember these stupid things 10 years from now. So the idea is, this is the thorax image we have seen already. How do we get that? Component-wise multiplication with this mask image here. Now, Fij times Wij is Gij. And how can I compute? Fij, I just divide Gij by Wij. And for the defect points, I divide by zero. Do we have achieved some kind of progress now? What do you think by this type of formulation? not really, right? We transformed it to a problem that we cannot solve. But there is an interesting conjecture here. There is an interesting link. And this is again engineering. If you see something like that, multiplication of signals, as a signal processing guy, if you see multiplication of signals, you should right away thinking about convolution of signals. Because we know the convolution theorem. The convolution theorem tells us the convolution of two signals in spatial domain corresponds to the product of its Fourier transforms. Now we have the product in the spatial domain, and I mean, it's just symmetric. That corresponds to a convolution of the Fourier transforms. So what we can say is that the product here implies that we have to convolve the Fourier transforms. And if we want to compute the original signal, we have to deconvolve the measured signal. And at that point, we are no longer talking about dividing by zero, but about a signal theoretic thing. And you will be surprised, we can do cool stuff with that. We will do that on Thursday in more detail. Just for you as engineers, if you see a product of two signals or if you see a convolution, always think about the convolution theorem from systems and signals lectures. Yeah? Okay, good. In terms of notation, first let's leave the domain of 2D images. Let's think about one-dimensional signals for simplicity. So we will do all the formalism in the following by one-dimensional signals like I did it with my interpolation example. Yeah? So we don't look at an image grid with intensity values, but we look at a one-dimensional function with function values. And the discrete ideal signal we denote by Fn, the binary signal we denote by Wn, and the observed signal by Gn. Yeah? So F ideal, W mask, and G measured signal. And now let's revisit the Fourier transform. I have pointed out the motivation already. And an engineer, again, you are not required to know all the formulas. You should know where to find these things. But to see this type of link is something that you should learn. Yeah? And that requires, at some point, also a deep understanding of the theoretical basis we are dealing with. So what is the Fourier transform? The definition of the Fourier transform is simply given by a linear combination of unit roots in the discrete. The linear combination of unit roots and the prefactors of the unit roots are the sampling values. What type of mental model do we associate with a Fourier transform? We decompose the signal into a linear combination of sine and cosine functions. Huh? Hello. Of sine and cosine functions and build things together. Good. So that's the definition of the Fourier transform. Fn times e to the power of minus 2 pi n psi divided by n. And then we know a few things. The Nyquist-Shannon sampling theorem. What does the Nyquist sampling theorem tell us? Right. How many sine and cosine functions do you need and of which frequency to be able to reconstruct the function? And the rule of thumb here is, or Nyquist sampling theorem, it's a precise result. It says you have to sample the signal with a frequency that is
double
the highest frequency in the signal. Yeah, twice the highest frequency in the signal. We have shown this. The convolution theorem tells us the relationship between the product of signals and the convolution of signals, either way. And we will also make use of a symmetry property of the Fourier transform of real signals. I'll show to you this later on because we will use it for the reconstruction. So, sampling theorem, the frequency of setting the sampling point is larger than twice the highest frequency present in the signal. And the convolution theorem is written here. If you convolve two signals in the spatial domain, this corresponds to product of its Fourier transform. And these properties we will use on Thursday to construct interpolation schemes that go beyond the interpolation scheme I have drawn with this simple piecewise linear approximation of the function. Thank you very much, and I'm looking forward to see you on Thursday.